Megillat Esther, and before we begin Perek Rishon, I want to just make our point in time. We went from Ezra to Esther. And what was the point of doing that, and how exactly do the times tie into each other? Now, actually, the way that we began when we decided we're going to move up from Ezra to Esther was to talk about it in terms of back at the ranch. And the reason that we see it as back at the ranch is because the truth is between the time of the Hachrazat Koresh, and in which he said that Kodesh Baruch Hu has given him the power over the entire world, and he wants to use it to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, and the Aliyah that was done together with Zerubbabel, in which Mordechai is mentioned by name. Between that time and the time in which the Ezra ends up himself coming, so many years later, completing the Binyan Beit HaMikdash, along with its chashivas, its spiritual chashivas, things were going on back in Bavel that very much involved that very person. And that was Mordechai himself, obviously. So something must have happened in between. Now, if you remember, at the beginning, back in Ezra, in the second parak, we have a list of the people that went together with the group that came together with Zerubbabel. Now, over there in the second pasuk, in that list, Ve'ela b'nei ha'medina ha'olim b'shvi'a gola asher ha'gla Nebuchadnezzar, is where the parak begins, asher bo'u im Zerubbabel, the ones that came, these were the leaders, were Yeshua, Nehemiah, Seraiah, Re'eliah, and Mordechai Bilshan. Now, the Gemara identifies Mordechai Bilshan as one name. Maybe the Pashtas you would read as Mordechai, comma, Bilshan. The reason that Mordechai is identified as Bilshan, according to the Gemara, is because he's Bolel L'shonot V'dorshan. However, we're going to see in the course of this Megillah that there's some extremely important reasons for him being called Bilshan. It's not just that he was an expert in language detection. He was capable of mixing various tongues and being able to understand one from the other and doing all types of very sophisticated analysis of languages. And in fact, we find him as being a Baki in the Shivim Lashonos, a member of Sanhedrin, the only one who was able to decipher what was going on with the Bigatan Vatarash. Later on, we'll see. And that's how he was able to uncover the conspiracy, because nobody else understood what they were talking about. And they in no way thought that some bearded guy from the Yahud was going to be able to understand what they were talking about. And that through that came the entire Yeshua of the Megillah. But that is very much a side point compared to the underlying importance of Mordechai Bilshan as a Bilshan. By the way, that word Bilshan has become the modern Hebrew word for language analysis. So when you study about Shanut, it's based on Mordechai Bilshan. That's how central our even scientific approach to languages sees the importance of Mordechai, but in a very subconscious way. We understand at the moment that you talk about the land of Bavel, you're talking about the land of language. That's clear. In other words, the development of language from the mythological point of view, everyone who wants to discuss language discusses it in terms of Bavel, the primal Bavel, the après Bavel, or the prior to Bavel, and what exactly happened in Bavel is the big question. Not as a real place to most people, but as what exactly happened to make language evolve in such complex ways that it appears to be speciated in so dramatically, when you would think that certainly a single species would have a single language. And Bavel, in the way it's presented, the Torah is viewed as another one of these primal myths that were there in order to explain how such a thing could possibly have happened. The issues in the Megillah are so much built around the concept of language, it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, the initial opening problems of Ahasuerus result in his change from an approach of a single language, which was the Nimrodian approach originally, Safahat with Dvarim Achadim, which introduced the original Bavel, which was the Migdal, and the idea of having a central government that was Moshel. The dugma of that government, of course, became known all over the world and throughout history as the smothering of dissent, which became the symbol of the Kifshan, in which we're Kovesh, we crush dissent, and that was Nimrod. In the end, Ahasuerus takes the opposite approach, literally the opposite approach, and where it is that Nimrod attempts to rule through the control of language, he attempts to rule through what becomes a populist government, or his attempt to make it a populist government, by turning language over to the masses. So it's an absolutely revolutionary thing. And again, anybody who's listened to the Megillah will remember the refrain of Am Va'am Kilshono and the Me'asrim V'sheva Medinot and the way in which Shiyeh Kolish Medaber B'lishonamo and so on. As if this is important to us, it sounds very, very strange as a background. But that aspect of what was happening in Bavel was very much part of the primal historic patterns that the Megillah expresses over here. And it expresses those primal patterns in almost a Gilbert and Sullivan fashion. I mean, the Megillah's Esther literally looks like a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. I mean, it's so absurdly exaggerated and so full of sarcastic comments about the way in which the government was carrying on that it attempts to cover something that is absurd to the point in which we have two different approaches to Achashverosh. We're clearly, we can't possibly have Machlokas Rav and Shmuel as to whether Achashverosh was an idiot or Achashverosh was brilliant, unless each one is calling the other one an idiot or brilliant. I mean, how in the world could Rav and Shmuel have different, they're each bringing out different aspects of the same man, because that's exactly what the Megillah is trying to do. It's presenting him in one fashion as a madman and a total nut. And this is the exaggerated aspect of the Megillah. And on another level, it's hinting at some of the big political issues that were going on in the time. We're going to see that this, too, is important in understanding the overall nature of Purim as something of a joke, which is the way we relate to it today. The Megillah sets out that joke, even though it's exceedingly serious. It's serious in a Gilbert and Sullivan kind of fashion, and it uses that for a very important reason, which we'll see as we go on. And in that case, it's something totally unique in all of this form of Tanakh, and that it actually attempts to be a satire, attempts to be a comedy, it attempts to hide tragic elements within an overall motif of strange and exaggerated language that we've already found is part of the nature of Bavel back in Daniel. Now, this Achashverosh is a rather complex individual, historically speaking, assuming that Achashverosh is Xerxes, which makes a great deal of sense because the Persian pronunciation of the Greek, they took Xerxes because they couldn't pronounce Chashrash. So the Chi Yevanit was as close as they could get to the Chet, which the Persians were using, the Achashrash, which became Xerxes. So it's very, very reasonable to assume that we're really talking about the same guy. And this, indeed, is the guy whose stamps and signatures and records have been found in Shushan HaBira. And that Shushan HaBira is very reasonably preserved today, enough to be able to reconstruct all of the events in the Megillah to the point where we could actually identify the exact place where Esther and Haman were sitting at the time that he ran out into the garden. It's an incredible thing. You get these satellite pictures and radar pictures of the palace at Shushan, and you can pick out precisely what was where. What's even more important is that it's weird, but Daryavish was the one who began the construction of this absolutely, I mean, it's enormous. It's a structure that dwarfs. There's a modern structure, I'll show you pictures of modern structure, which looks very, very impressive in the foreground, which was built for the archaeologists who were, the French archaeologists who originally started work on Shushan. And then when you look at the size of the actual Palace of Shushan, the remains of the Palace of Shushan as compared to this thing, and this thing looks like a major castle, you get some sense of what we're talking about over here. Daryavish, remarkably, left golden and silver tablets buried in the place as very much the modern idea of the cornerstone, which have those hollow large stones placed in the corner of a building, and you put in the records of what had gone on in this building. And these things are all there. And in it, he records the type of materials, not only the type of materials, but also the way in which they were transported, the workmen and the places that the workmen had come from in having built this palace. And it's an amazing story in which the crazy things that we read in the Megillat Esther with all of these wild things from all over the world and these incredibly precious stones and all of the different precious metals, He actually lists them, just as they're listed in the Megillah, and tells us, you know, where they came from in detail. This was imported from there, and this was imported from there. When you read it, in the, it sounds like this, you know, Arabian Nights story, the opening. But he actually did this. So that Shushan was something special. Shushan was something great. We know that Shushan, there were really three capitals. And we've spoken about this before when we talked about finding the letters of Koresh and Hamadan, which was not the place where they were expected to be found, because some of the people that were against the building of the Beit HaMikdash clearly had gotten to them. And that brings us back to Mordechai, because we find Mordechai Bilshan right up there going with the Zerubbabel, and yet here he is back in Ahasuerus's castle, becoming an important man in the palace for some reason. And there is a fascinating Rashi that actually explains how that happened. And it's really based on a Medrash. So the Medrash says that the reference in the Pasuk, where we know that later on in Perek Dalet in Ezra, as we just had, so it says, Vayishmu tzarei Yehuda v'Yamin, ki b'nei ha'gola bonim ha'ichal, and they were absolutely out of there. I mean, they wanted very, very much to stop that. So they began by attempting to take control over the rebuilding, if you recall, and they offered to donate money and to be involved in the building, and they were summarily rejected by Zerubbabel, who said, Lo lachem lanu livnot bayit. Because of that, goes on the Pasuk to tell us, they hired a bunch of lawyers and they hired a bunch of lobbyists. So chrin alehem yoatzim, lafer atzatam koyeme koresh melech paras, the Admalchut Daryavesh Melech Paras, was the second Daryavesh, the son of Ahasuerus and Esther. Now, we already found that that Daryavesh not only reinstituted the support for the Beit HaMikdash, but it was absolutely crazy, the things that he wrote. It was almost as if he was a plant in which he forced all of the governors of the entire area of the Trans-Euphrates, as they called that area, which included Eretz Yisrael, all of them had to supply from local taxes anything that Ezra demanded. And they were not to interfere in any way upon pain of death and worse if they would even open their mouths about the building of the Beit HaMikdash, to the point where he really appears to be more involved in this rebuilding than most of the Jews were. Now, if he really is a plant, so to speak, in which Mordechai was specifically sent back to make that happen, it begins to make a lot of sense, as does the way the Gemara understands all of the discussions at the various parties with Ahasuerus, that this constant refrain of the Ad Chatziah Malchut V'Tayas, to us it sounds weird that Ad Chatziah Malchut could possibly have meant don't raise the issue of the Beit HaMikdash, because that's not the Chatziah Malchut, that's the Chotzeh HaMalchut. That's the one thing we're not going to be able to agree on. It's creating too many political problems. If Mordechai is the one that is the guy, as the Medrash says, that was sent, Amru Yisrael, this is Lashon HaMedrash, Amru Yisrael, Mordechai min Shevet Binyamin, and Shevet Binyamin, after all, is the one in which it says, Uben Ketefav Shachin. So that's where the Beit HaMikdash not only was built, but as the Gemara says, it was not only built, but he was also the one that was mitzdayer olav every day, even from the little piece of the Yisod that was still in the Chelek of Yehuda. So there was a complete identification in Binyamin for that Beit HaMikdash. Because of that, he should be the guy that we send as our lobbyist. So Yered Prusbuti Kenegdan Mordechai Livnot Beit HaMikdash. At the same time, says the Medrash, who was the one that was attempting to run the whole effort of the lobbyists against the building of the Beit HaMikdash? A gentleman named Haman. So Haman Yarad Levatel, and this is the reference in Ezra to Ubimalchut Ahasuerus Betchilat Malchuto Katuv Sitna. Who wrote that Sitna? Says Rashi, Ra'iti B'Seder Olam, the Aseret B'nei Haman that are ultimately hung, they were the ones Shekatvu Asitna Yudav Yerushalayim, Kama Shekatvu B'Sefer Ezra. That's in the fourth parak, Malchut Ahasuerus, B'Tchilat Malchuto, Katvu Sitna. What was the Sitna? Levatel, Ha'olim and Agalabi Mekoresh, who had begun to build the Beit HaMikdash, Yilshinu Aleim Akutim, and indeed Ichdilum, And they stopped. And we went all through all of that story back in Ezra and the various economic means that they were using, the claim that they were destroying actually the whole financial center by doing this, because the Jews that were moving out were the ones that had been in charge of the fancy metalwork and all of the jewelry exports. So it was on every possible level, the dangers of rebellion, the way that the Beit HaMikdash was a place that constantly caused problems. That was actually done by the Aseret B'nei Aman, so that the Shamshai, who was the sofer that is mentioned over here as being is one of those Bonim of Aman. So in the whole story of the Megillah, in which the Zagor puts it, Shamshai Kotev, is Mochek, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu restores the Ktav, and he's trying to get rid of the Sefer Divrei Hayamim, and all of those things that had been preserved at Hamadan, that we find afterwards, really involves exactly where we were at in Sefer Ezra. So we truly are going back to the ranch. Now, if you take a look at the actual size of the palace, remember that this building here is a modern building. It's 100 or so years old, which was built for archaeological purposes. Remember that it's very much in the foreground. The ruins in the background are so much larger, as you could see. They're in the background, and they absolutely dwarf this modern building. That is the Palace of Ahasuerus. The building, although here it's in very, very bad shape, but remember that there were a number of different capitals, and what's even more interesting is that they utilized the same architecture very much as what happened at the time of Hordas. And not only that, they used some of the same people, because they found the same actual chotamot of the people that were in charge, they found in both places. So because of that, using the Persepolis palace, we can actually reconstruct. This is done not by Jews. This is just regular architectural stuff. This is the Apadna, which would be the area right in front of the which is called over here the Chatzar Ginat Bitan HaMelech. It's various levels. That was right outside of the area of the throne room and so on, which is absolutely enormous. You could see what kind of, these were Arzei HaLivanon that had to be transported hundreds of kilometers to get there, which Daryavish explains how it is that he actually managed that kind of thing. So that you could see that when we're talking about this immense, you get an idea of the size by seeing, this is a Persepolis. Do you see the size of the people? That's to give you a sense of what we're talking about. We'll see as we go through the middle. We'll figure out all of these various. But, I mean, here you have a modern human standing next just to, like, the little fancy design at the bottom of the column. It's amazing what we're talking about over here. So what Daryavish actually writes about this thing is just is astonishing. By the way, before we talk about it, I just want to show you a beautiful, I'm so sorry I didn't have this in Ezra, but there is an actual copy of a Koresh inscription in which he uses word for word the language that's quoted in Ezra, in which he was given, the gods have given him the rights to the Malkus all over the world. It's very, very beautiful to see. It's the same lotion that we found. Of course, I won't find it now. Here it is. So, and this is in Ur, right? It's written from Koresh, in which he writes, the Elohim gave me kol malchiot haaretz, which is the quote from the beginning of Ezra. So it's almost word for word what it is that he writes in that first part. So this is the same Koresh. Okay, so but just listen to what it is that that Daryavish writes about how it is that he invested in this place, and you'll get a sense of what the exaggerations appear to be, the crazy exaggerations. So here's what he writes. This is from Daryavish, which he signs this document. The palace that I built at Shushan, its ornamentation was brought from afar. The excavation down was 40 amot. This is about 58 feet straight down. And they went all the way down to the very bottom rock. And on that rock, the palace was constructed. And the cedar timber was brought from a mountain named Lebanon. I had the Syrian people bring it to Babylon. From Babylon, the Carians and Ionians brought it to Shushan, and the other Yaka timber was brought from Gandhara and from Carmania. The gold was brought from Sardis and from Bactria. The precious stone, the lapis lazuli, the carnelian, which was wrought here, was brought from Sogdiana. The precious turquoise stone was brought here from Bukharisma. It was wrought here. The silver, the ebony, were brought from Egypt. The ornamentation with which the wall was adorned was brought from Ionia. The ivory was brought from Kush and from India and from Araxia. The stone columns were brought from a village named Abiradu in Elam. The stone cutters who cut this stone were Ionians and Sardians. The goldsmiths who wrought the gold were Medes and Egyptians. The men who wrought the wood were Sardians and Egyptians. The men who wrought the baked brick, those were Babylonians. The men who adorned the wall, those were Medes and Egyptians. Darius, the king, says at Susa, very excellent work was ordered, and a very excellent work was brought to completion. So this is really quite a place. To get an idea of the size of this thing, take a look at the reconstructed diagram of what this place was. This is on a scale in which this room alone is about 55 meters long. 55 meters, just this room. Okay. Now, just that just happens to be, they put the scale over here near that room. Right? So, I mean, you're talking about, to get from one end to the other of this place, you're walking half a kilometer. I mean, it's crazy. Absolutely mishugah. So, again, it seems to be something of an exaggeration in the Megillah, and then when you come to the place, it starts taking on real dimensions. And we have to recognize the historical setting to get a little bit of sense of what's happening with this poor Ahasuerus. Because basically, he starts off really good, and then he gets into very severe trouble. This we spoke about back in Daniel when we were analyzing the various visions that Daniel had of how it was that at the end, Paras is given over to the Yavanim. And in the end, of course, Alexander the Great takes over both Shushan and Persepolis. But what's interesting is that all of Alexander's partying about the Churban of Paras is in Shushan. Despite the fact that we relate to it far more in Persepolis, he is himself very taken by the fact that he has captured Shushan. So apparently that was the major capital, and that was something that, according to many of the Farshi Mikra, Ahasuerus was the one who brought about, and originally it wasn't really the main capital. So it was Kishevet HaMelech Ahasuerus, according to many of the Mefarshim. That's when he was Yoshev B'Shushan HaBira. To understand the importance with which Kalal Yisrael views the events in Shushan particularly as being central to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash is to recognize that there needed to be, in the reconstruction of the Beis HaMikdash, there needed to be a gate which was called Sha'ar Shushan. And it was called Sha'ar Shushan because it actually had a picture engraved over the gate of Shushan HaBira. Unbelievable. Says the Gemara, why did they want to have a picture of Shushan HaBira, of all things, in the Beis HaMikdash, which of course is also called Bira, HaBira Asher Achinoti. So here it's as if we have two capitals, so to speak, who are making themselves important, and we at that time actually put a picture of Shushan HaBira there? And the Gemara says a remarkable thing, to remember where you came from. So that means that we really see the events in Shushan as not having been merely saving us from the negative. In other words, it wasn't simply a question of how it is that we made it through despite the Gezeirah of Haman and so on, but actually something far more complex. And as we mentioned briefly while we were learning Ezra, the greater complexity was the complete and absolute change in the way in which we viewed what a Beit HaMikdash would be, what a Jewish nation would be, far more profoundly than the events that changed everything in Daniel. So remember, in Daniel we came to understand what it meant to suddenly get a grasp not only of the development of Malchut in its various stages, historical stages, but also what it meant to change the vision of what Yisrael was in the context of Galut, that it wasn't a temporary stage, but was part of a new identification of what it is to be a Ben Yisrael within Galut, not just that you sit there and wait for a geula, but that the major developments in the identity of Yisrael are the child of Galut and not the child of Yeshiva and Eretz Yisrael. This was a dramatic change, but it pales in comparison to the change of what it means to be an Am Hashem. So that, remember, up until that time, we saw the beginning of the activities of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, which was Ezra's Beit Din, and he was the one that changed, they're called Anshei Knesset HaGdola because of the fact that they changed that vision, being able to reconstruct a new understanding of what HaEl HaGadol HaGibor VaNora means, which the Nevi'im themselves felt that they needed to drop because of the fact that it was just not relatable to in the way in which we were living. To talk about it at a time of a Holocaust, HaEl HaGadol HaGibor VaNora, seems to be making a joke of it. I mean, as the Gemara says, what right do you have to drop the words that Moshe Rabbeinu had instituted? And the Gemara says, well, because God is honest. It doesn't expect us to lie. What are we supposed to say? You're a great and awesome God? You're not even around. How could we say that? You don't seem to be involved, to care. I mean, there's no indication anywhere in the world that you exist. Well, what makes you great or what makes you awesome? And they actually literally dropped those words. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola were the ones that were Machzir Atara LeYoshna, had a different understanding of what it means to be an El Gadol, Gibor, and Nora. And that change in understanding came because of the events that we are about to learn in the Megillat Esther. And it's part of the reason that Megillat Esther is written in Gilbert and Sullivan fashion. Because the truth is that up until that time, the very idea of the Hanhaga of a Beit HaMikdash and the very idea of what a Beit HaMikdash was heavy. Because it was heavy in the same sense as being heavy-handed. It was based on interference in the natural order. It was based on the way in which God would show himself and get rid of his enemies and do as Ezra himself was embarrassed to admit that he had said to the king, and that was the reason that he couldn't even ask for reinforcements. He says, well, I told him that God takes good care of us, so I couldn't possibly go back and ask him to send soldiers. He said, why do you need soldiers if God is on your side? Now, in the whole story of Esther, there is no mention of God, and no mention of any kind of overt help or changes in the natural order at all. And to such an extent is this definitive of the book of Esther, that we know that the Perek in Tehillim, which refers to Esther, which is called Lamnatzecha L'Ayelet HaShachar. So the Gemara says, why do we refer to Esther as Ayelet HaShachar? Because just as the Shachar is the end of the night, so too is Esther the end of miracles, which means that we view the end of miracles as the beginning of dawn and not as the loss, which it was seen up until that time. So that means that the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash was now seen as part of the way in which a natural order would allow us to exist in what appeared to be total Hester, which of course is the remnant of the name Esther, which the Gemara says is the makor of the name Anochi Aster Astir, which is the absolute Hester, the deepest Hester of Geula, that it's specifically there that we discover the Ayelet HaShachar and a totally new way of relating to God, which is something that gets us back in a very deep way to the original ideas of the search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence that Avraham Avinu had started us out with and that had become more and more an institutionalized religion during the period of the Beis HaMikdash, in which the things that had been there, as the Rambam explains, in order to provide for us a path of development that would allow the creation of a true Am Hashem that would discover Derech Avodato, instead became linked to series of primitive kinds of belief in which Nisim were more important than nature, in which God's presence was not detectable in anything that would be natural, but the opposite, that it's always the special guidance of the Lord that provides for what Yisrael is. And the whole idea of Bereshis, Bishvil Yisrael Shenikra Bereshis, is essentially lost. It becomes simply a world of, in the Ramchal's word, Hanhagat HaMishpat, which if you're good boys, then we take good care of you, and you're bad boys, you get punished, and so on. And all of that changed in that one pasuk that more than anything else brings out the idea of the existential value of Yisrael rather than the mechanical need for providing for Yisrael. And that is the Revach Vatzalah Yamoda Yodim Makom Acher, that we don't have any interest in mechanical manipulation. We will not engage in mechanical manipulation on our end. We don't see what it is that we do as being more than of local meaning. And if in the end it turns out to be part of a pattern that is the way the world is, why, that's a grand opportunity for us. But it certainly is not going to change the historical patterns. And understanding that patterns and Pur itself, which of course is why Purim comes from this whole story of Esther, Hashem HaPur, which is in itself just randomness. It's the lottery. And that idea is the name of a holiday that's astonishing, and that it should be the name of a holiday that harkens all the way back to the only other time in which we have lotteries, which of course is Yom Kippurim, where we do lotteries and we're not allowed to use anything but lotteries to be koveya, the Sayer Lazozel and so on, is not coincidental, pardon the pun. And the idea there is, as many of the, I mean, it's known as the Arizal, but many of the Sfarim point out that indeed Kippurim really does mean a day like Purim, which means that in a sense, the real understanding of what that was all about and how what randomness means to a modern human being begins to enter into the consciousness of Yisrael, and they begin to focus on existential values rather than mechanical ones. This was all changed because of this book. Therefore, sending Mordechai, and you understand how much the development of language is part of this, because that's exactly where our relationship to the world around us comes from and is expressed in. It itself is the most randomly developing thing that we know of on a short scale. And yet it's immensely powerful in dealing with the way in which we relate to everything. The Mordechai Bilshan and the Esther of Hester, who together achieve this, are only capable of being included in a Gilbert and Sullivan play. And you can begin to see why that would be true. It's the opposite of the entire heavy-handedness of the idea of the Beis HaMikdash. It becomes something of a joke, and the way that people look at it, it's a joke. Seen from the perspective of randomness, Achashverosh is a joke. Seen from the local perspective of people dependent on him and needing to take seriously his own personal hang-ups and needs and paranoia, this is horrific. But from the point of view of Gilbert and Sullivan, what is a mass rape fest becomes a beauty pageant. But of course, with the understanding of what's really happening under the surface, the great king, who apparently can't manage to sleep with a woman without this kind of insanity going on, is made into a parody. And all of the weird kind of issues that are happening between him and his wife, and the story of the party and the changes that were going on that were going to have such massive historical implications, are reduced, in the simple words of the Megillah, to the personal peccadilloes of some crazy guy who's got a lot of problems. And there's a reason for this, because the truth is that's exactly what we do in a postmodern historical analysis of things, right? There's, instead of taking it so seriously as it was, you know, we'll tear apart the guy's psychology and look, well, this was really because he had this and this problem and needed to deal with this and this issue. And we look at the whole thing very much instead of with the respect and profound feelings of importance that were going on at the time. We really do look at it very much like Gilbert and Sullivan would take apart, you know, the Queen of England while she's sitting there, but she wasn't quite certain what was happening. But, you know, at least they are Englishmen, and whatever our faults, we love our queen. And this was coming out, you know, in the course of the Megillah as well. I think it's a beautiful dogma, because it's very, very similar to the way that they handled political satire in their own time. So with that understanding, with the understanding of what poor Xerxes or Hashrash or Hashverosh was going through at the hands of the Greeks already, this is way before the final end comes at the hand of Alexander, in which, as we learned when we were doing Daniel, the entire fleet is destroyed in a freakish fashion, just when he was at the peak of his power, in which he loses the central battle of his life, comes back, and now here he is, sort of defeated, trying to hold on to power. And the only way he's capable of holding on to power, as we'll see, is by holding on initially to Vashti, who brings that seat of power all the way back from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, gives him a sense of legitimacy, where now he's been very marginalized because of these defeats. All of this is the background. How important it is for the foreground? Not very. If it were, of course, we would have to know about the historical details that would be given to us in the book. It's not. The reason that it's not is because, as is often the case, as we've seen in all of this forum, we don't really care about the specific local issues. The books are not meant to be historical books because the history plays very little role, except as a general sense of the milieu. That's all that we need to know. We don't need to make it hook up to a particular moment of history in which we're going to say, oh, this was done because of, and so on. That's like taking a sheet in the Gemara and making it dependent on the fact that there were economic difficulties at the time that made it. I mean, that's certainly true. Of course, the milieu has a tremendous amount of impact. That's the nature of halacha itself, is that it's responsive to the milieu. But it's not a question of direct linkages. It's a question of generalized background. And therefore, taking all of that into consideration, the universality of the book, the issues that are achieved in the book, are exactly what was needed for the creation of a Beis HaMikdash that was hopelessly inadequate from the old-fashioned view of what a Beis HaMikdash was. So inadequate that we found the reconstruction of the Beis HaMikdash in Ezra to be far more a tearful occasion than a happy occasion, as the Pasuk puts it in Ezra. There was so much crying and wailing that you couldn't even make out the sounds of the orchestra and the music and the happiness and the champagne bottles popping because people were so disappointed with the way that this was working out. And the truth is that it was a very gradual change, so gradual that the only place that we find out that our hero is not quite a hero is in the Megillah itself, in which, well, it was Ratzila Rovamo. Most people approve of the way he had handled the issue. You sure get the feeling there were an awful lot of people who didn't approve, but mostly it was okay. And, of course, until today, we have exactly the same kind of problems. We have the same feelings of the desire to reconstruct the same primitive religious view in which nobody's got patience with randomness, evolution is somehow itself some type of heresy, the way in which the world develops in the overall sense with the incredible and moving patterns that are so much more meaningful than any heavy-handed attempt to control things, that it's almost laughable. Those things, ad hayom, are still a question of, is it Ratzila Rovam or not? So we're still handling these issues. We really haven't gotten to the bottom of it, but the change, the tremendous paradigm change, can be traced back to the book that we are about to begin.